Session number 8263, Reel 5.
Captain Ives Rutliff, Reel 5. Could you tell me about Meckley Wells, what it was like there and what you were doing there?
Yeah. Well, immediately after we finished this, I think it was an 11-day operation, giving artillery support to Skinner's Horse and so on, instead of going back to our normal base at the the Atbury River, we went to Meckley Wells, which really was from the surrounding countryside and everything we had experienced up to then, it looked like a piece of the Garden of Eden. There was a circular flat sort of maidan in the in amongst these three enormous rings of trees, which all joined one onto the other, giving the effect of three circular tunnels with just exits and entries here and there. Camouflage was absolutely easy and wonderful, because all one had to do was to cut the inner branches of some of these things, and you could get the gun and the limber vehicle and just drive, and like driving into a small aircraft hangar, a very, very large garage. The centre part of the this thing, because of the water, it was quite green grass, whereas outside, where there was grass, it was all brown and burnt with the heat. And plumb right in the centre was an enormously high water tank. Now, the locals from the nearby village used to come up there with their cattle and sheep, and emptying cans of water, empty petrol cans tied onto donkeys and so on, and fill up water and take it back to their villages. With the cattle grazing in the centre of this arena, as it were, it was ideal for us, because we used to have, as I mentioned earlier, these Liberty wagons used to go into either Khartoum or Atbara to the Nafi bulk issue place and bring tea, sugar, tin milk, cocoa and things like that. Well, we would just go along to these chaps with one of our petrol cans, which had been cut in half, and a wire handle put to it, and the milk straight into it. They had rather a peculiar way of inducing the cow to produce the milk. I don't know whether it was just imagination or not, but they'd lift the cow's tail and slap its fanny with a bit of leather or something like that. We would get our milk, and it'd have these numerous sheep just wandering around. They didn't come and interfere with us at all, although they were quite tame. And it used to be quite smelly and horrifying at times, because these chaps, the shepherds, were extremely tall, handsome men, awfully smelly, with fuzzy hair, with lumps of camel, balls of camel fat, stuck around the end. Anyway, they had their haversack rations on the hoof, and when they wanted a meal, they'd just catch one of these sheep and slaughter it. And their means of cooking was to have dig a hole vertically on the one hand down, about 18 inches or so, and then another one from about 2 foot away, going at about 45 degrees and meeting up with this, the first hole. The first hole then would be filled up with stones, with a roaring fire underneath it. The stones would become hot. They'd just throw lumps of raw meat onto these hot stones, and that was their means of cooking. We, for ourselves, had plentiful water. and absolute leisure, because John Gordon, the troop commander's sort of order of the day, as far as we were concerned, was that there wouldn't be any vehicle and gun inspections. It was up to us. And he said, if you fall by the wayside by not maintaining your vehicles, and we've got to beat it, you'll be left behind and no one's going to come and try and help you out. So that's that. So everyone really got stuck into the marvellous jobs, whether they were drivers or gunners or whatever, signalers. We didn't do any training as such from there, but what we did do, initially, the whole troop of four guns used to go out unescorted in amongst these hills on the Sudan-Eritrean border, and would just sort of drive around, probably, you know, not drop into action, but ready to do so. And we would spend probably a week living like this, sleeping in the open. And cookhouse would be set up under a tree or some bushes or whatever. And then we'd come back for a week. And this carried on for two or three sessions. Then the troop was split into sections, and you'd find one section would go out for, let's say, 5 days, and the other section stayed in, doing the usual maintenance and washing clothes, etc. And then there'd be a change about, and we'd pass each other on in the desert. You could see for miles, you know, clouds of dust and what have you. And this interchange business went on till December.
Did you actually go into action at all?
No. We just went out and deployed. Sometimes we'd have the Sudanese armoured cars with us, and they would go snooping around the hills and so on, but we didn't actually have any engagements as such. The only engagement that we did have was, as I mentioned earlier, B Troop of the battery were down at Djibit, and the troop commander there, Captain Esmond White, he was hell-bent on, you know, popping off a few rounds into Castle, because John Gordon had done it. And so anyway, he flew up to Meckley Weld, and there's a lot of rumours that went along about the dissension in the officer's mess tent, about Esmond White wanting to fire the whole troop, and John Gordon saying, no, you can't do that. Anyway, the outcome of it was that our gun went out to do the actual firing, and B subsection, the number two, they came as anti-tank protection. We set off in fairly good time. We weren't all that far from Castle at the time, and the gun was brought into action. And we were firing, position was at maximum range, which was near down at 6,000 yards. That was the spade guns dug in to get maximum elevation. Anyway, we had a fairly leisurely shoot. Nothing whatsoever came back at us. And at the end of the, I think we must have fired about 30 rounds or so. We set off for home, but not without having had problems while we were actually shooting, because these guns, being very, very old, the spring buff and recuperator system. Of course, the spring for the system broke. And there was a terrific sort of clanging and rattling noise and so on, and the gun wouldn't sort of get into a normal position, you see, so it had to be pushed by two members of the detachment, and it's fire again, you see, and this was the same performance. But anyway, we got the job done.
How easy was it to replace a component like that if it broke?
Well, I suppose the fitters were well stocked up with spares, but you know, they being a tribe of their own, they live more or less separately, you know, from the gunners and the cookhouse, and they tucked away in some far corner of the wagon lines. But I should imagine that they would have had the stuff. But at that, I can't actually remember what happened, whether this thing was repaired or not, because we weren't called upon after that to use the thing for actually firing.
What sort of firing position were you in? Was it the same as in your first bombardment of Castle?
Yeah, it's the same sort of countryside, these stunted pine trees of sorts and sandy soil. So extremely deceptive, because the surface was just looked nice clean sand, but if you try and dig into it, you can get through about 9 inches or a foot, and then you hit soil which wasn't rock but was as hard as rock, and I had to literally use a pick to chip little bits away before you could to get your slip trench done. We didn't dig a gun pit because it was only going to be a short-term shoot. And anyway, we got back without incident.
Could you see the target on this occasion?
No. It was, 6,000 yards away. It's actually in Castler. Now, as a follow-up to this, at that time, we weren't given any indication of how successful this particular one-gun shoot was. And about 10 years ago, about 1974, I went to officers' reunion dinner at the House of Commons, and Captain Esmond White was there, but as a retired brigadier. I recognised him instantly, but there's one Esmond White, but there's a hell of a lot of gunners, and particularly not being in his troop, see. So he looked at me rather questioningly, and so there must have been a faint recognition. So anyway, I went up to him, and I said, excuse me, sir, but I'm Captain Ive Ratcliffe. At the time when we knew each other, I was Gunner Ive Ratcliffe, and I fired your first shot in anger, which really, sort of surprised him, that after all the number of years, that someone who did a good job for him should go up and inform him of such. Anyway, he then told me that we had knocked out two guns, which I thought was rather belated. I mean, we might have had our morale boosted a bit by when we got back to camp or on the, the OP to the GPO, saying, damn good show, we've knocked out two guns, but nothing. I mean, it takes 130 years later,
How far ahead was the OP? How far?
I should imagine the OP would have been about 5,000 yards from us. Because you had this the belt of these pine trees, and then there was the some palm, like a fraud thing, And I think the OOP was up on one of these. Well, there was a great space between the edge of these palms and Castler itself, you know, where the, and then the guns wouldn't actually be in Castler, but, you know, on the sort of outer perimeter. But I went through later, you know, after the push, and the place was totally evacuated, but you could see from the time when we first went and shelled it, how well fortified it was. It was just circled with tank traps, and you could see the gun position, you know, gun pits and things like that, and a typical lot of Italian rubbish lying around, particularly contraceptives and things like that, you know.
Have you any idea why they didn't fire back?
I have no explanation at all for that, except that probably one gun only firing at them, they couldn't locate it. Because we weren't doing anything with intense fire. It was, you know, a round and then a great lull. So they wouldn't have time to sort of pinpoint it. They'd probably get the direction, but not the range.
So it's really harassing fire.
Yes, it was just needling them a bit, and giving Esmond White a bit of morale boosting. He'd actually been in action.
How did the OP transmit back to the gun position?
Mid line. There were wireless sets, but I don't think there were, you know, much use really. I think it was mainly line. On occasions like that, we also laid the line, but there were never any problems. But at Karen later on in the campaign, the lines were continually being, you know, cut, shell fire and so on.
You mentioned the Italian rubbish. What sort of things were typical Italian rubbish other than the competition?
Well, other than, of course, these contraceptives which were lying around there like confetti, photographs, you know, snapshots of some of them were family, some were, you know, groups of soldiers. Quite a number of them were these soldiers with these Abyssinian women with bare boobs and, you know, fondling them, you know, sort of vulgar stuff. You know. Old haversacks, old shoes, you know, where the British soldier would have buried all this kind of stuff. They just couldn't care less, you know, and the place, any position that we later pushed them out of, just reeked, particularly the machine gun nest, you know, in sort of cheap scent. Yeah.
What were these tank traps like that you mentioned?
They were cut in into the ground at about 45 degrees going down, and then the vertical, which would be probably 6 or 8 foot. The slope in was too steep for a vehicle to, or a tank, to reverse out of. There was a number of occasions when, you know, driving at night, odd Sudanese to 1,500 weights or something, you know, they'd get bogged down in these. But, you know, with other vehicles around, they were able to sort of tow them out.
What about their gun pits?
The gun pits were, as such, they weren't on the British pattern. They're, invariably, the protection for the guns was made up with ammunition, live ammunition in the boxes. I mean, that was their reserve. They put a, you know, a semicircle or three parts of a circle of the stuff round. And to a height of probably 4 foot or something or the other, with a a little space, you know, to get the piece, you know, to sort of fired through. But they weren't very keen on digging gun pits or slit trenches. They're very good at them, very deep.
To me, it sounds as though that would be rather dangerous, having live ammunition stacked around.
Well, this is what I thought, and later in the campaign, in after Karen fell, we on the plane, and I went and had a look at one of these bits, which had had a shell explode not very far from it, and busted open the box, and there was a round of shrapnel with a great piece of the shell casing that's missing, and you could see all the pellets, you know, held in position with resin or whatever compound that they used. But I don't know what a direct hit would have done to one of these. Probably sent the lot up in a hell of a bang. But I thought I couldn't understand it. I got no explanation as to why they did that. Probably having the ammunition is near at hand for easy handling. And they thought, well, if we're going to get hit, we'll get hit. And
what about the machine gun nests? Were they well constructed?
They were well constructed. They had ample room, particularly if they were on a, you know, on a hillside. They're quite deep, you know, quite you know, for a man to walk around in quite easily, and for probably three or four people to sleep in, and the stand or platform for the machine gun and with the observation slit, which is only about 3 inches deep, and they had several of these things. You know, we found the mess tins and things, you know, like primer stoves or something, you know, so that they could brew up.
Did they have good fields of fire and lines of sight, these machine gun posts?
Oh, well, yes, yes. I think if they hadn't been weak-hearted, they could have held anything at bay. But I'm talking about what I've seen after the battle, because, you know, the long-range snipers, you know, thousands of yards behind, because we don't see all of it, but you only see it when you actually overrun a position. But the barrages that used to go down on these places was very, very, very intense indeed. And it's, even if one of these machine gun nests wasn't hit, the saturation of artillery shells landing near them would be enough to, you know, destroy any morale that they had. Because nothing, there was no half measures. When a barrage went down, it went down thick and heavy.
So presumably they wouldn't be able to see very far.
No, there'd be, you know, the black smoke and the thing, you know.
But I think we're getting ahead. You were telling me about Meckley Wells. How did you come to leave Meckley Wells?
I think it was about the last week in December. No, I beg your pardon, about mid-December. We moved off to be re-equipped at Khartoum with 25-pounders. So by this time, the whole concept of our role up there had more or less sort of come to an end. And I think the Sudanese Defence Force, I think they stayed behind. And there was some, probably Skinner's horse was stayed. We went back to Khartoum and just drove into the ordnance yard and dropped and unhooked the 18 pounders, hooked up with 25s, and drove out just as easily as that. The only snag was that the handbooks that we were given were for the 18 pounder, I beg your pardon, the split trail 25 pounder. I think that was the one. Anyway, we had the box trail job, so it wasn't a great deal of use to us. And no one seemed to know anything about the new dial sight. You see, on the 18 pounder, you had the 180 degree right, 180 degree left, whereas on the 25 pounder, and the dial sight basically is much the same, but you had a slipping scale which you brought down to zero. And instead of saying right 2 degrees or left 2 degrees, one said more or less. Anyway, this was soon overcome, because when we moved up from Khartoum, we had a week over there, and we went down to the area around Gedaref, and we, alongside the 144 Sussex and Surrey Yeomanry. Now, they had already come out from England with 25 pounders, so they're well conversant with them. So they used to send their number one from, you know, gun to gun, and they sort of educated us in the new system.
How long did it take you to get used to the new gun?
Oh, it was hardly any time at all. You see, everything was sort of simplified on it. First of all, you had this dial sight, which, when the guns were being laid out for on zero lines, it was exactly the same sort of thing as with the 18-pounders or any other gun, except that one slipped the scale to zero, and then you knew exactly where you were. The other thing was that you had the gun platform, and where the 18-pounder with the pneumatic tyres and modified wheels and so on, were always off balance. With the 25-pounder on the platform, you could, with one hand, you could go through 360 degrees. It was so simple and so comfortable and easy. There's no pushing and shoving and grunting to do a job.
Did these guns have pneumatic tyres?
Yes, oh yes.
How did they handle when they're being towed?
Extremely well. If you went, like anything else, you know, being towed over bumpy ground, they bounce away. But you know, they were really, really good.
What sort of range could you get out of them?
Well, with firing supercharge, I think you could get. I'm not too sure on this, mind you, but I should imagine about 20 to 25,000 yards, as opposed to six, because you had the charge one, charge two, charge three, and supercharge. So,
and what about rate of fire? How did that compare with the 18?
Well, it was much slower because it was split ammunition, and the preparation, of course, you know, took longer. For example, I mean, one got a gun program, the charge was on it. It meant that the cartridge case, the cardboard stopper, had to be removed. And if you're firing on charge two, you took out one bag. Charge one, which we often did, you'd have to remove two bags. You know, there's red, white, and blue. And of course, the supercharge was all was like sticks of spaghetti. That was all. There was no preparation or